To take the original meaning of the 14th Amendment seriously is to really take economic liberties seriously. I'm George Thomas, an associate professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. I specialize in American constitutionalism, American political thought, constitutional law. For most of our history, beginning in the late 18th century and throughout the 19th century, there wasn't this rigid distinction between personal and civil liberties and economic liberties. The first and great Civil Rights Act of 1866 names specifically labor of liberty of contract, the right to own property, the right to convey that property, rights that are now dubbed economic liberties. Those were what they were describing as civil liberties, and those were sort of first and foremost in their mind. That liberty included the right to make choices about your occupation, to make choices about contract. The government could, of course, regulate those things in all sorts of ways, but it was limited in how it could regulate them then. And that distinction starts to get thrown out beginning in the 20th century as the government begins to engage in more and more regulation. Part of the argument you have in the early years of the 20th century, and you get it from some quarters, but it sort of starts to disappear, is that when it comes to economic liberties, and when it comes to, say, something like liberty of contract and bargaining between employers and employees regarding minimum wages and maximum hours laws, that the state in some capacity, whether it's the states or the national government, needs to intervene because these are not equal, these are not people in equal bargaining positions, that the laborer is going to be at the mercy of corporations, and therefore they need the protection of the state. But the argument that really takes shape in the 1930s, say, is that these aren't liberties at all. And so you never have a debate about whether you need adjustment in regard to civil liberties. And instead, you end up with the court, urged on by the political branches, simply reading these liberties out of the Constitution altogether. And so you simply take, you know, decades of constitutional history and logic and say, well, this was all wrong. This was never part of the Constitution. In any capacity, and the things we're now going to protect, these are civil liberties, and economic liberties don't count. Most justices these days tend to view economic liberty through what I'd call the New Deal telling of history. So-called laissez-faire court is a invention of progressives and New Dealers, and it's in that narrative that you get economic liberties written out of the Constitution, and in interesting ways that narrative has more or less been accepted by liberals and conservatives. And so you don't have support for economic liberties sort of across the political spectrum. Having digested this New Deal telling of history, they tend to think that any protection of economic liberties was in fact an instance of justices engaging their own sort of politics or economics. But both liberals and conservatives, and the terms are sort of difficult to use on the court, but we'll use them for conventional reasons anyway, came to accept this understanding. And so even originalists like Justice Scalia, for example, view the Constitution through this lens in part, especially the Due Process Clause. And so they've been reluctant to revisit the early years of the 14th Amendment and the framing debates there because they think that those liberties should not be legitimately protected. I mean, what would be interesting is if they did revisit the history, would they be potentially persuaded by it? If you took the court's jurisprudence seriously, say from the last 20 years of the 20th century, and said that rights named in the Bill of Rights are subject to what the court calls heightened scrutiny. The court is going to look at them, the laws that fall upon them, far more carefully and closely and subject them to a much higher standard than it would other legislation because they fall within what's come to be defined as the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. And yet, when the court has actually turned to one of these clearly enumerated rights, that is, that the Fifth Amendment guarantees that private property shall not be taken without just for public use without just compensation, the court has redefined that standard in two ways. And this was sort of most spectacularly done in the Kelo decision, Kelo v. New London, a few years ago. The court, first of all, applied a lenient standard of review, what it calls the rationality test, or a simple reasonable standard of review, to a textually enumerated right in the Fifth Amendment, the Takings Clause. So first of all, they watered down the protection available to that right by applying, sort of against its own precedents, a much lower standard of review than you would normally get for a right listed in the Bill of Rights. But it also twisted the language of the Fifth Amendment and turned public use as something that the state could seize for the public to then use into public purpose. And the public purpose definition is much broader. And it would allow, say, in the Kelo case, a private entity to take public land if it would use it for potentially more profitable purposes. Because there would be, within this private land taken and given largely to a private corporation, the Pfizer Corporation, who incidentally has since pulled out of the economic development deal, and so won't be bringing the jobs and profit that supposedly the private homes were seized for. But because they included within this space a couple of public parks, it looked like one could say this was for a public use in some capacity and not simply for a public purpose. But the real logic of Stevens's opinion in Kelo seemed to suggest that any sort of economic development that might make the state or the city better off would be an acceptable standard. I mean, the public parks within the broader economic development scheme sort of helped fudge public purpose, public use. I think the essential logic of Stevens's opinion pointed to economic development that the state or the city happened to think would be beneficial. And by that standard, it seems that you could seize blighted property, so-called blighted property, from citizen A and hand it over to private entity B if the state said, well, we think B will use it to better purposes. The Privileges and Immunities Clause is potentially going to enjoy a resurgence. In some sense, it seems odd to say that given that on a 9-member court, you just had 8 members say they didn't want anything to do with the Privileges or Immunities Clause in the McDonald v. Chicago case. But in scholarly circles, it's enjoyed a serious renaissance. And the real question there then is, so what's included in the Privileges or Immunities Clause? You had, for instance, a number of academics of a more liberal persuasion supporting the petitioner in McDonald v. Chicago, saying that the Privileges and Immunities Clause is really where liberties and rights should be defined in the 14th Amendment. It included Michael Kent Curtis of Wake Forest Law School, Jack Balkin of Yale Law School, as well as prominent conservatives like Stephen Calabresi of Northwestern, more libertarian scholars, Randy Barnett of Georgetown Law Center. Then you have a debate of, so how do you determine what's included in privileges or immunities? And sort of one of the easy answers is full fundamental rights. But then the question is, well, what are fundamental rights? And in the 20th century, fundamental rights started out to include, again, middle years of the 20th century with the New Deal Court. They included speech, they included religion, they included those things essentially named within the first 8 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Those were fundamental rights. But that's broadened over time. You now have a right to privacy, which then included a right to abortion. And there's a question, is there a fundamental right, say, to gay marriage? So what is a fundamental right is part of a serious debate. Now, what a lot of these groups don't want is a return to any form of economic liberty in any way. They say somehow those aren't fundamental rights. But that's a debate we ought to have insofar as if you simply look back to the framing of the 14th Amendment, a number of the liberties that they were speaking of, fundamental rights as they might call them, that ought to be protected by the 14th Amendment included what we now call economic liberty. So it seems difficult to simply say, well, they're not there. It seems that we need more of a debate about, well, they were there, why should they no longer be here?